On Tech News Today, we've got new details on last year's epic Sony hack. Plus, Facebook is still failing on diversity, and Microsoft's HoloLens is headed to the space station. It's all coming up next on Tech News Today.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for Tech News Today is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Tech News Today for Friday, June 26th, 2015. This episode is brought to you by Warby Parker Eyewear. Get boutique-quality, classically crafted eyewear, including sunglasses, at revolutionary prices. For a free home try-on of five stylish frames of your choice, plus free three-day shipping, go to warbyparker.com/TNT. Tech News Today is the show where we talk about the tech news with the journalists who report it. Welcome to the show. I'm Mike Elgin, and our co-anchor today is Mashable senior tech correspondent Christina Warren. Hey, Christina, how you doing?
I'm great. How are you, Mike?
I'm doing great. Now, on the screen, if you're watching the video version, you'll see that Christina has been rainbowified. The Supreme Court today ended marriage discrimination, and rainbows are showing up all over the internet, including like things like Twitter icons. But Facebook has a tool to rainbowify your profile picture. And Christina, is that what you used for your profile?
That is exactly what I used. I thought it was a great little tool that they'd made, made it very easy to do, and wanted to show my support for SCOTUS ruling.
Yeah, it's just, it's awesome, and we're going to get a lot more Supreme Court rulings coming out over the next couple of days, I think. And that is fascinating news, and also, you proved this week, Christina Warren, that one person can make a difference. There was a tear in the Seinfeld verse where somebody created a Jerry Seinfeld apartment. They recreated the Jerry Seinfeld apartment from the TV show Seinfeld, and there was one thing wrong with it. Can you talk about what happened?
Yeah, so the show is now streaming on Hulu, which is fantastic, and so Hulu decided to recreate Jerry's apartment. They did a really good job. I was super excited. I went to see it early at a press preview, and I go over to the nook where his desk is, and I'm very excited to see his computer, and I'm shocked and horrified to find a compact presario staring me in the face.
Unbelievable.
As everyone knows, exactly. It's unbelievable, Jerry. And so as, you know, as Seinfeld watchers know, Jerry Seinfeld was not a PC man. He used a Mac.
Yeah.
And so I wrote a post about it. I talked about it on Twitter, probably to the chagrin of my Twitter followers who are not both Mac and Seinfeld nerds like I am. And as of yesterday, Thursday, a friend of mine went to see the apartment, and Hulu actually replaced the computer with a Mac.
Unbelievable. Well, well done, I say. Well done. Accuracy is very important. In these things?
It is very important. Well, and frankly, I thought about it. I was like, you know, this is the sort of attention to detail, this sort of like mess up is the sort of thing that would drive Jerry Seinfeld insane. And it would probably be the topic of an episode of Seinfeld if it were done today.
Yeah.
So, you know, I mean, my being pedantic, I think, was necessary for all of us. And if I could, you know, be the Taylor Swift of the Seinfeld replica market, then I'm happy to have played that role.
Wonderful. Absolutely wonderful. And I hope that Lloyd Braun will be able to sell that PC. Well, why don't we jump into the news? Our top story today, the hack last year of Sony Pictures Entertainment was widely labeled as the worst corporate hack in history. But what really happened? Fortune writer Peter Elkind tackled the subject in an epic piece published this week. An article based on 50 interviews with current and former high-level executives at Sony, security experts, and law enforcement officials. Welcome to you, Peter.
Good to be with you. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for coming on. Now, what made this breach, as you called it, the hack of the century?
Well, it was different from anything else. It was really a landmark event because it didn't just make off with that's damaging itself with personally identifiable information or credit cards, but it really laid low the entire company. It destroyed half their computer network. It really threw them back into the age of the Betamax, as we say in the story.
So, Peter, I've first of all, great, great reporting, and I'm a big fan of your work. I love the smartest guys in the room. You know, I've looked at these emails and these documents from the hack extensively. Disclosure, when they were being released, you know, through BitTorrent and whatnot, I was one of the reporters who was kind of going through them trying to find information and whatnot. And, you know, there are a lot of reports that say that, you know, SUNY's IT chief was too lax about security. From my own assessment, that certainly seemed to be the case. There were certainly very poor information security practices, at least with passwords and how that data was stored. Do you think it's fair to characterize their security practices as being overly lax?
I do think it's fair to characterize them as overly lax. And part of the reason is because of what Sony had been through previously. They were a hacker target for a decade because of their aggressive efforts to protect their IP, and they'd angered hackers for years. I have a comment from one expert, Bruce Schneier, who said, you know, they've been the company that hackers loved to hate for a decade. So they had suffered a long history of assaults, especially most notably the PlayStation hack in 2011. And in that year, they had another dozen hacks, 20 hacks throughout the company, and they vowed to improve their cybersecurity. So if anybody should have been at the top of the top of the scale in terms of cybersecurity, Sony had every reason to be, and they just weren't.
Now, the narrative that's been sort of handed to us is that Sony Pictures Entertainment made a dumb movie based in North Korea called The Interview. Okay, I actually enjoyed it. It was, you know, dumb humor, and that's my favorite kind.
That's fair enough.
Yeah, and then in retaliation, the North Korean government, through proxies or whatever, executed this hack. Now, how likely is that whole scenario?
Well, we don't know. I mean, let's start with what the government position is and what the sort of official view of this is, which is that it was North Korea and it was done in retaliation for the movie because they were, some reason, unhappy that Sony Pictures was making a comedy about the assassination of their dictator, of their sovereign ruler, I should say. Now, the FBI and Sony and President Obama have all concluded that it was indeed North Korea. But they haven't put into the public realm what the critical clincher was in terms of persuading them, they say, of why it was North Korea, which is intelligence. And in the absence of all the information being on the table, there are a lot of skeptics that North Korea was really behind this. In addition, there's a lot about the details of the hack and how it played out that kind of don't make sense, don't fit neatly with the scenario that North Korea was behind it. North Korea was doing this in order to keep The Interview from seeing the light of day. For example, when the hackers first made contact with Sony, it was actually a few days before the devastation on November 24th, they made a vague demand. It appears to be the same group or related group. They made a vague demand for money. They didn't mention The Interview. And then finally, when the devastating hack unfolded on November 24th, wiping out half of Sony's computer network, they also didn't mention The Interview. In fact, it was more about 2 weeks after it had been raised in the media as a possibility that the hackers actually even discussed The Interview, referred to the film, and then eventually made threats to of a 9/11 style attack against theaters that showed the film.
No, those are great points. What was the biggest surprise that you uncovered doing your interviews and research? And, both the first two parts and three parts are out now, but what was the biggest thing that surprised you kind of going into this?
Well,
or coming out of this, I should say.
Sure. No, I appreciate it. This is not a surprise to you guys, because you're in this world, but this is a new realm for me, and I did not appreciate what a murky universe this whole realm of hacking and cybersecurity is. I mean, it's really a fascinating, dark place, very complex. I hadn't reported on it before, so that was a revelation for me, for starters. Another element of it is I through the hack materials and in reporting the story, I learned, what kind of pressures people were under at Sony Pictures. A part of the story that I tried to weave in to the tale of the hack, because I think the context of the business, what was going on, the pressures, the personalities, are really necessary to understand the whole tale from beginning to end. I mean, a lot of people have written, obviously, a lot of very good reporting about what happened, especially on the tech side. There's been lots of publicity about Amy Pascal's emails and what she and Scott Rudin said about Angelina Jolie and other celebrities. But our goal really was to try to put the whole tale together, not for tech audience, but for general audience. while understanding with a pretty good level of sophistication. So that was our ambition for the piece. And the kind of pressures and window into the business that offered was pretty interesting.
Now, I'm curious about your judgment. I'm sorry. Go ahead, Christina.
So I was just going to say, no, you're dead on. I mean, reading through those emails, you certainly saw the pressure that the executives were under, especially, you know, Amy and Michael Linton. Amy Pascal obviously has lost her job over this, partially because of this. It seems to me anyway, they've made her the fall person. From your perspective, how is Michael Linton still the CEO of Sony Pictures?
I'm sorry. How does Michael Linton remain CEO? Is that your question?
Yes, exactly. Like, how is he still in this position now, 7 months later?
Yeah, well, that's a question for Tokyo rather than me. I think, you know, one of the major insights I hope from this story is that is what Sony could have done and didn't do, and what warnings it did receive, Sony Pictures received, and how it responded. Again, for starters, there was the history of hacking that the corporation and even Sony Pictures had dealt with, and sort of the imperative to ramp up their cybersecurity for that reason. Second, they in June of 2014, as you know, they came under very strong criticism from North Korea over the movie, and also their CEO in Japan was very concerned about how it might affect Japanese-North Korean relations, which had always been difficult. So with that going on, they set about the appropriate task of assessing what the risk was that they might face. What might North Korea do? They were making all sorts of, you know, very angry noises and threats, not about cybersecurity specifically, but about this movie and how terrible it was. So they set about to explore the risk, but they didn't do it in a comprehensive way. Let me back up one more step. I mean, this is a film company which conducts surveys, audience tests, focus groups about every single aspect of a film it's releasing because there's a lot of money at stake. They hire consultants. They do meticulous studies. They spend a lot of money and time to do this in a very comprehensive way to try to turn the business of making profitable movies into a science. Well, here they had this great unknown of criticism by North Korea, threats in general of North Korea. And there, instead of hiring any experts to really look at what was going on comprehensively, Michael Linton called up some people who knew some people who he knew. Now, the people he consulted were genuine experts in the field. One was the Assistant Secretary of State, in the area of that part of Asia, and one was a fellow at the RAND Corporation named Bruce Bennett, where Michael Linton served on the board. One of them called a friend of his who was also an expert, but ultimately Linton himself spoke to two people, didn't hire a firm to do any kind of comprehensive research, didn't do kind of thorough risk analysis that they do for any one of their films. And having done that, Russell, the State Department expert, basically said, you know, the North Koreans bluster often. Sometimes they mean business and sometimes, but most of the time they don't. But we're really not going to get involved and tell you what to do. This is, you know, you have every right to show the movie and, you should do what you choose to do. The North Koreans will do what they do, movie or not. They might use it as an excuse, but that's all I can tell you. And then Bruce Bennett at the RAND Corporation, he is the fellow that Michael Linton spoke to most extensively, received a 3-page memo from him, had many conversations and emails, really relied on him heavily and forwarded his memo, for example, to Kaz Hirai, the CEO of Sony. And Bennett said, on balance, you know, the North Koreans tend to bluster and a lot of it's empty threats. But he also told me that he specifically raised the prospect that North Korea might engage in some kind of cyber attack against Sony, that they had a cadre of trained hackers, that they had a history of engaging in cyber attacks. And he says, the Dark Seoul episode in 2013, which was quite devastating in South Korea. And he said that something like that, he wasn't saying it was a likelihood, but he said it was a possibility. That's what Bennett says. Sony denies this.
Now, the South Korean hack you're talking about involved ATMs, I believe, if I recall, the money spitting out thereof and so on. Peter, I want to apologize to you because I would like to talk to you about this story for 2 hours, if I could. Unfortunately, I cannot. Let me ask you quickly, are you going to write a book about this?
Oh, I have no plans. It's an amazing story. I think it's worthy of a book. I've written some books. It's a pretty great tale, but I don't have any plans to do that. I've got my day job. And I'm very happy with it.
All right. Well, if I can convince you to take on a night job, I would like to do that. And I really want to encourage every single person watching or listening to this show to go find this article on Forbes.com and read it. As Christina pointed out, parts one and parts two.
Fortune.com.
Did I say Forbes?
You did.
Yes, you did.
My apologies. On fortune.com, you will not find it.
We got to correct it in real time. So
yeah, yeah. You will not find it if you don't look at fortune.com. So go to fortune.com, read it. Parts one and two are out there. Part three is coming this weekend.
It'll be online tomorrow, and the whole story will be there at that point.
Wonderful. Well, Peter Elkind, again, is at fortune.com, and you can also find him at peterelkind.net and PElkind1 on Twitter. Peter, thank you so much for joining us today.
Very good to be with you. I enjoyed it.
All right. In the wake of scrutiny and criticism over Silicon Valley's appalling lack of workplace diversity, Facebook launched into a major effort over the last year to bring real diversity into the company. And they failed. Alex Barinka is a reporter for Bloomberg News and joins us now to talk about it. Welcome to you, Alex.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Thanks for coming on. Now, what has Facebook done to increase diversity, and how have their diversity numbers changed?
So it seems like they've really focused on a few initiatives that Maxine Williams, Global Director of Diversity, kind of laid out in a blog post yesterday, whether it be Facebook University going in to reach out to freshman students and kind of drum up interest for, you know, women and minorities to get into the tech sector early, or, you know, pushing this idea of the Rooney Rule that comes from the NFL, which encourages recruiters to look for minority applicants when there are open jobs and get somebody from a group that is not, you know, white male to apply for open positions. So, and obviously Sheryl Sandberg has continued to raise awareness for getting more women into the workplace. But like you said, you know, when you look at their total numbers this year, they're still 68% male. They were 69% last year. And then when you start to kind of peel the onion a little deeper, the trend really does seem to continue.
So this is a question that I did not write, but it is a little bit trolling, but kind of funny. So go with me here. So Facebook is a company, U.S. company. They have more than 10,000 employees, and something like 62.6% of the U.S. population is white. And now 55% of Facebook employees are white. So does this mean white people are underrepresented at Facebook? And Mike, I cannot believe you wrote that question.
Well, thank you, I think.
So,
go ahead,
you know, if when you look at it, I guess by the numbers, there's potentially an argument that yes, I'm not a statistician, but by the numbers, it looks like it doesn't align. But when you do start to look at, you know, the tech jobs and senior leadership jobs, you know, the other numbers are about half of the population is women, and there's still only 16% in the tech gigs, 23% in senior leadership. So, you know, they might not have as many white folks there as the general population does, but they don't have as many women either.
One of the things that makes this very complicated, and the reason the percentage of employees at Facebook of white employees at Facebook is lower than the percentage of white people in the U.S. is that Silicon Valley, of course, is a global community, and people from China and other Asian countries and India are wildly overrepresented. And this is something you don't hear a lot when you look at these diversity numbers. And clearly,
that's a great point.
White people are overrepresented in leadership positions. That's definitely clear. The higher you go at Facebook, the whiter and maler it gets. But it is an interesting thing that I think that people should be looking at, and especially in terms of what it does is it highlights the challenge of bringing real diversity into a company like Facebook when you have this enormous numbers of highly educated, highly skilled people coming out of India from IIT and out of China and Japan and Korea and other Asian countries. So it's really kind of an interesting phenomenon. Now, women, of course, this reminds me a lot of Google's diversity numbers, where they worked and worked and worked and worked and basically made no headway at all. What is Facebook doing to increase the number of women, and for that matter, minorities in their ranks? What action are they taking?
And Mike, to your point, so they are kind of looking earlier. They're trying to educate people. And to your point, there are very qualified people who, you know, don't necessarily make these diversity numbers look much better. If the majority of the people who are coming into your office are, you know, white or Asian males, and you don't have, you know, the deep bench of recruits, then that is difficult, which is why, you know, I expect that they are going to the kind of younger college-level people to try to drum up the interest here. And you know, it's interesting talking to women who work in the tech industry in the Valley here in New York. There's this interesting conundrum where they don't want to be just filling a diversity quota. They want to be truly the best person for the job. So there's always kind of this interesting dichotomy of, yes, you know, it seems we have shown, Facebook is admitting that a more diverse workforce is something that's good for the company long term. But on the flip side, you know, you still want the best candidates. So again, that's why I think they're going in early. They're launching things like the computer science and engineering lean-in circles to show that people have a path forward at the company, even if they don't look like what management looks like today. So much of this is getting in early and finding a broader base of potential recruits to hire to kind of bolster some of these numbers.
Sorry, Christina, did you have another question? Or?
Yeah, no, I was just going to say, has Facebook really laid out anything, I mean, other than what you just said about what they're going to try to do to actually increase the number of people that it hires and promotes? I mean, as you said, it's great for them to talk about wanting to bring in people that don't look like the status quo, but are they looking at implementing any more sorts of, you know, Rooney policies to improve things? Because, you know, frankly, after, say, a year of lip service of really wanting to focus on things, that the results aren't very different from what they were a year ago.
Right. And the other thing that they've been touching on in terms of what they're actually doing is they've reworked this managing bias training course to kind of help people become aware and address the fact that you might have unconscious biases that are kind of keeping you from bringing maybe the different looking person in the door. I completely agree with your point. It has been a year and we're not seeing these numbers go up. And, you know, they came out and Maxine Williams admitted there's more that they need to do. It's a smart thing to do. And the proof is always going to be in the pudding, though. So I guess we'll have to wait and see what happens next year if any of these initiatives and the kind of raising awareness turns into actual action and makes these numbers look a little bit more like a balanced 50-50 approach.
Alex, you also wrote a piece that hit this morning pointing out that Barry Diller, it turns out, is the biggest matchmaker in the history of mankind. Can you talk about IAC's Match Group, who they are, what they do, and what is going on with that company or that group?
If you are finding love online, chances are a 73-year-old billionaire helps you get there. So Diller's IAC is this kind of interesting grab bag of internet companies, and within it is this Match Group, which has Match.com, OkCupid, Tinder, and a swath of other dating sites that are targeted toward really niche markets like Mormon people or Black singles meet or Republicans meet. And he has kind of, you know, grabbed all of these into this one business, learned from the different things that are successful at each. And now, they project fourth quarter of this year, he's actually selling about less than 20% stake, giving investors an opportunity to bet that he knows what he's doing when it comes to online dating. But, you know, this is, especially Tinder within that portfolio, has really been on the minds and the tips of tongues of us media folk and people in the tech world as well. So, potentially giving investors a chance to nab a bit of what they have going on there.
Very interesting. Alex Barinka is at Bloomberg.com. You can follow her on Twitter at Alex Barinka. Thank you so much for joining us today, Alex.
Thank you.
Self-driving cars have an excellent safety record so far, but now various news outlets are reporting that two self-driving cars nearly crashed in Silicon Valley yesterday. One was a Google car, and the other was from Delphi, which is a Silicon Valley-based automotive supplier that is also developing a self-driving car. The stories were based on comments made by a Delphi executive. Melissa Riofrio is the executive editor of PC World and joins us now to talk about this story. Welcome, Melissa.
Hi, Mike.
Now, can you tell what was being reported yesterday? What were so many of these news outlets reporting about what happened yesterday?
Well, it all started with a newspaper report from Reuters who'd been interviewing this Delphi executive. And the Delphi executive apparently said that he had been driving in a Delphi self-driving car when a Google self-driving car cut them off.
It sounds like something that you would be in a late night sketch. I mean, it really does sound like a monologue, a sketch here. What have we figured out? I understand you've got some new information from Delphi. Is that correct?
Yes. So I wrote up the story last night, and this morning I got an email from Google saying that the Delphi executive had retracted his statement.
Wow. So you also had made an interesting point in your article beyond just the reporting on the incident about why this matters, why it matters whether self-driving cars are crashing into each other or crashing into other cars and so on. Can you talk a little bit about why we should all care so much about the safety records and the goings on of self-driving cars?
People are very interested and suspicious about self-driving cars because there's no one behind the wheel. They feel like they don't know who's driving this. Are they going to be as responsive? Are they going to be thinking about what's going on around them in the same way that people do? Let's be honest, not all people are good drivers. And these self-driving cars are being taught to be better than we are. But there are split-second decisions that you sometimes have to make as a driver. The classic one that we always talk about is, if you're going to hit a dog or a pregnant woman, which one do you pick? And what would the self-driving car do? And, you know, that sort of basic moral decision, how do you program that into a car?
It is one of the most interesting factors in all this because, of course, it will have to be programmed into the car, the split-second decisions. You know, do we take out four bicyclists or do we crash into the car that has five people in it? On the one hand, the people in the car have safety, you know, might have seatbelts on. The bicyclists are going to be towed. You know, those types of decisions are actually going to have to be programmed in. Should we sacrifice the owner of the car, the person who paid for the car, in order to save the lives of people who are outside the car and so on? It is one of the most interesting ethical dilemmas of technology that have cropped up in the last few years. And we'll see how they respond to that. I personally want a self-driving car that would enable me to live three hours away from work and sleep the whole way. So anyway, someday, perhaps. Someday.
Yes.
I can dream, can't I? Melissa Riofrio is at PCWorld.com. And you can follow her on Twitter at MRiofrio, PCW. Thank you so much for joining us today, Melissa.
Thank you.
All right. The crew of the International Space Station will be getting Microsoft's HoloLens augmented reality system on Sunday, long before you do. I guess nothing beats an astronaut. Alex Knapp wrote about it for Forbes and joins us now. Welcome to you, Alex.
Hi, thank you. Glad to be on the show.
I'm so glad you're here. Now, this is part of NASA's project, which is called Sidekick. Can you talk about what Sidekick is?
Sidekick is their product that incorporates Microsoft HoloLens for use on board the International Space Station in two realms. One is a training aid. Astronauts have to do a whole lot of things on board the International Space Station, ranging from maintenance to scientific experiments. And one thing NASA wants to do is to be able to shorten the training time by using augmented reality glasses and Microsoft's HoloLenses to kind of overlay instructions for astronauts to train. The other thing that NASA's working on with the Sidekick project is something called the remote expert mode. So if there's someone on the ground in Houston who can solve the problem with some expertise that nobody on board the space station has, they'll actually be able to communicate in real time via Skype and even draw an overlay and write instructions for the astronauts to see what's going on and hopefully solve the problem faster than in Apollo 13, where they had that big table full of equipment and solved the problem, but then had to talk them through it audio only.
That is so cool. And it totally takes up the demo that Microsoft is doing with HoloLens, you know, of replacing a pipe to a whole nother level. So what is OnSite?
OnSite is another project that NASA's working on that will also employ HoloLens that will actually let scientists connect in, I'm going to put real time in quotes, with the rovers on Mars. I'm putting in quotes because there's actually a signal delay thanks to the speed of light. It actually takes a few minutes for signals to travel back and forth to Mars. But it would basically enable a scientist on Earth to virtually travel on Mars through the rover systems and walk around and interact with the environment.
And, of course, HoloLens would enable NASA astronauts to play Minecraft in space. Now, you mentioned that NASA is using another augmented reality system in addition to HoloLens. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. Yeah. NASA's actually been working on augmented reality for over a decade, but primarily in the software realm. And so they've been partnering with different commercial companies to work on a solution, one of whom is the Osterhout Design Group, which has AR glasses that is currently in use and being tested by the U.S. military. It's not as sophisticated as HoloLens, but it does, you know, it has the virtue of being out there and in use already. And NASA's also going to be testing that. And NASA typically tests multiple commercial solutions, so this is a part of their status quo, just see which one works better for what they want to do.
All right. Well, Alex Knapp is at Forbes.com. You can follow him on Twitter at @TheAlexKnapp. Thank you so much for joining us today, Alex.
All right. Thank you.
All right. Got more news for you coming right up. But first, let's talk about glasses. Let's talk about Warby Parker. It's our sponsor today. Warby Parker makes really, really beautiful glasses, prescription glasses and sunglasses for both men and women. And you really, if you wear glasses, you really have to try Warby Parker. Summer has already started, and that means you're going to need some sweet sunglasses, and Warby Parker is a place to get them. They make glasses out of the same high-quality materials sold in boutique shops. You can find glasses that are made with these high-quality materials for $400, $500, more than $500. Warby Parker, they're far, far less than that because they're outside the whole world, the whole monopolistic world of the glasses that you see. Most of those glasses companies you see, they're all owned by the same company. And Warby Parker is not part of that cabal of glasses manufacturers. They were recently selected as the number one most innovative company for 2015 by Fast Company. Warby Parker is so groundbreaking that they have imitators all over Silicon Valley. You hear a lot of companies being described as the Warby Parker of food or the Warby Parker of clothing. Well, Warby Parker is the Warby Parker of glasses, and you want to go straight to them whenever you need glasses, especially if you need a pair of glasses that have progressive lenses. I myself love progressive lenses, and for a while, Warby Parker didn't initially have them, but now they do, and they have the best type of progressive lens that gives you the widest field of view. This is a fantastic service, and again, you have to try Warby Parker. Just try Warby Parker stylish glasses with a free home try-on program. Just go to warbyparker.com/TNT, choose 5 pairs of glasses, and Warby sends them to you so you can try them on. They include a special frame box and a prepaid shipping label for easy return. Simply choose the frames you want, enter your prescription details if needed, and Warby Parker takes care of the rest. And for every pair of glasses you buy, Warby Parker will send a pair to someone in need. So give Warby Parker a try for stylish new pair of prescription or sunglasses. Go to warbyparker.com/TNT. Get the free home try-on and get the free 3-day shipping on your final frame purchase. That's warbyparker.com. And don't forget, /TNT. And we thank Warby Parker for their support of Tech News Today. We've got a quick correction for you. Yesterday, I reported that Apple would pay artists 2 cents for every song streamed during Apple Music's 3-month free trial period. I suggested that it sounded like a lot for them to be paying, and it turns out it was a lot. The actual amount they'll be paying was 0.2 cents, significantly less than 2 cents. And so, again, that is a correction. It's 0.2 cents that Apple will be paying. We've been covering Europe's right to be forgotten rules. In a nutshell, European law requires search engines like Google Search to offer a process for people to request censorship of search engine results. Specifically, if searching for that person's name brings up links to content that stigmatizes the person and is not in the public interest, the search engines are required to change the results. But now the BBC has started publishing a list of pages that have been removed from results because of the right to be forgotten. And of course, they join other, mostly UK publications, in presenting those lists. It's kind of an interesting thing, Christina Warren, that these publications are being, you know, links to these publications are being censored, and then the publications are listing the links, overcoming the whole point of the right to be forgotten.
I love it. I love it. And this is, it's so funny. You and I, this is one of these topics we seem to talk about almost every week.
Yeah.
It's something related to this case, and we have for the last year or so. And no, I mean, I think that this kind of proves why these sorts of laws are so difficult and some might even say silly to even try to enforce, because ultimately the Streisand effect kind of comes into play here, where I guess my big question is, how are these pages that the BBC is publishing, are those going to be indexed by Google? And will that be something that the EU legislators will try to claim can't be shown to in search results to their citizens?
Yeah, and of course, there's a huge Streisand effect going on right now. I mean, if you look at the list that the BBC published, it is a long, long list. A ton of stories have been censored from the search engines through the right to be forgotten. And the truth is that these stories have all been forgotten. But now they're on a list,
yeah.
And now we're talking about them on internet TV. And people are going to go and start clicking on these links and reading these stories. And the whole thing is, like you said, it's being defeated, and that's a good thing. So anyway, not a big fan of the right to be forgotten. Well, in product update news, Yahoo updated its mobile search engine to emphasize images, videos, and reviews. The new format was launched today and can be seen in mobile browsers, including Chrome and Safari. In government crackdown news, the Chinese government has banned Reddit, according to a discovery made by the Independent newspaper. The site joins Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, YouTube, and Google as sites that are blocked in China, and so they are in good company. What took them so long, Christina Warren?
Yeah, this is going to be my question. I was going to say, I would have thought they would have been on that list already, especially knowing everything that Reddit has to offer. So for both good and ill, I mean, if Instagram or YouTube is already on that list, you would have thought Reddit would have already been there. But hey, you know what? The first sign that you know that you're doing something important in the world is if China wants to block you.
That's right. You know you're on the right track. And hopefully we are blocked in China. I would be very proud of that. Well, in news, news you can use, a new live streaming service wants to compete with Meerkat and Periscope the old-fashioned way by being better. It's called Rhino Bird. Unlike Meerkat and Periscope, which stream video delayed by as much as 30 seconds, Rhino Bird is real-time, according to the company. It's built on WebRTC and works on Android phones and also from a desktop or laptop web browser and without a plug-in. The company says that they'll have an iOS version later this year. The service is currently in beta. You can check it out at rhinobird.tv. Christina Warren, have you ever heard of Rhino Bird? Because before this morning, I had not.
No, until right now, I have not heard of them. So, what is it with all these streaming services having weird, like animal names?
Yeah.
Meerkat, Rhino Bird.
Yeah.
What's up with that?
Yeah, right. Cheetah Stream. I mean, it's like, That's not a real thing. I just made that up. But yeah, you just like they're conjuring these images of the savannah or wherever it is that meerkats live. Who knows? Well, news you could lose. We told you Wednesday that Lexus had built a real hoverboard that uses liquid nitrogen-cooled superconductors and magnets. And we showed you their video. Well, a Spanish website called El Patin tracked down the skate park where the video was shot. It's in a small town called Cubelles, which is near Barcelona, Spain. Lexus built this custom-built park just for the hoverboard. It's got what appears to be a metal track, which makes sense since, of course, the hoverboard works with magnets. What's interesting about this to me, Christina Warren, is like, you know, there's a question about whether they built this for the video or whether they built it for real. And I think that, you know, I think it's for real because most of this this track was not in the video at all. Of course, they may be working on a larger video. They're going to reveal this later in the year. But it looks like they've got metal going up ramps and downstairs. And so somebody who is hopefully wearing a helmet will be able to skate like on this almost like a rail if you look at it.
Yeah.
It looks amazing.
It looks very cool.
Yeah.
It looks amazing. It looks like a very fun, very dangerous ride that in another life I would like to take part in.
Yeah, absolutely. And I have a relatives who are really into skating, and they must be super excited about this. Talk about friction-free capitalism. This is like friction-free skating. Very, very awesome. Well, we got an email from Mattia Schultz, who sent us an email asking us about the story that we reported yesterday about Oracle's Java and Yahoo. Basically, the way it works is that they will basically train, when you install Java or update Java, they'll change your default search. They'll try to change your default search engine to Yahoo instead of Google or whatever it is that you currently have. And here is the email. Every 3 weeks, an Oracle Java security hole requires an update. And every 3 weeks, each of us will have the opportunity to accidentally install Yahoo and their unwanted toolbar. Is this a conspiracy? No, I don't think so. But it does reward Oracle for putting out very popular and buggy code. For that reason, I think it's a horrible idea. I think I should be rewarding them for the junk they put out? Question mark. As a side note, the same issue applies to Adobe Flash, which has security holes every 3 weeks and also tries to put software run services on my machine. I think this is not a conspiracy, but I do not see why they should be making money off of us all the time when they're wasting our time patching their own insecure applications. Anyway, have a nice day, he says. So, I pretty much agree with that exactly. So I have no further comment other than to say I agree. Well, our TNT fan of the day is Josh Isaacs in Kentucky, Tennessee, who posted this picture on Google+. Josh watches the show on his breaks while working the night shift. He's watching on a second-generation Nexus 7 via Pocket Cast. And there's Christina Warren lording over his break in the middle of the night.
I love it.
Yeah. Glad to see that he's not driving. Well, show us how you watch or listen to TNT. Just record a video or take a picture of yourself or your setup and post it on Instagram, Google+, Twitter, or Facebook and use the hashtag HowIWatchTNT so we can find it. Christina Warren, besides making the world of Seinfeld simulacrum right by adding Macintoshes, what are you working on these days?
Yeah, you know, just a bunch of various things, kind of playing around with some things with iOS 9, kind of diving into some of those betas and seeing all the good stuff that's coming up with the Apple's next OS. And taking a look at just some other kind of, you know, general, it's kind of a slow tech week, to be totally honest with you. It's been sort of a slow tech week, so just been kind of giving iOS 9 a thorough walkthrough, and we'll have more stuff on that in the coming weeks on Mashable.
Well, it's a dirty job, and somebody's got to do it, and I thank you for doing that. Christina Warren, have a great weekend, and we will see you next week.
See you next week. Thanks, Mike.
Take care. Bye-bye. You can subscribe to Tech News Today on Pocket Cast, on the Pocket Cast app, just like Josh Isaacs. You can choose another way to subscribe at twit.tv/TNT. You can watch us live every weekday at 10 a.m. Pacific, 1700 UTC at twit.tv. Just click the live button. If you'd like to help us grow our audience, here's how to do it. Just post a link to twit.tv/TNT on your favorite social media site and tag three friends and recommend that they subscribe. You can follow us on Twitter at Tech News Today TV and follow me on all the social networks at elgin.com. Don't miss Tech News Tonight at 4 p.m. Pacific every single weeknight, and that is the Tech News Today. The show is produced by Jason Cleanthes and edited by Brian Burnett. My name is Mike Elgin. Thanks for tuning in. We'll see you Monday. It'll be a while.